This week, the changing face of currency.
There are certainly some people who don't view the US dollar as a perfectly functioning currency.
Technology is creating new forms of money and new issues. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, the Women's Perspective. Bitcoins have been in the news lately, with a Chinese Bitcoin exchange firm vanishing, along with $4 million. A teenager in Australia whose Bitcoin bank website took in more than $1 million, then vanished. And the world's second Bitcoin ATM set to open in Hong Kong this month. Online sellers are increasingly accepting Bitcoins, while central banks are warning against a volatile and unregulated form of money. Bitcoins are virtual currency, with one coin currently selling for more than $850. Unlike government currency, Bitcoins have no central authority, and they're issued based on a mathematical formula. Dr. Tyler Moore, professor of computer science and engineering at Southern Methodist University, spoke with WTIP's Buck Benson about the appeal and the challenges of virtual currency.
Bitcoin currency was first set out and described in a paper written by someone under the pseudonym Satoshi Nakamoto, and who's believed to not be a real person. But what Satoshi Nakamoto proposed was a mechanism for representing these bitcoins, and some enthusiastic programmers sort of latched onto this and made it a reality. And the curious thing about Bitcoin is that there you have to have this way of actually introducing new coins into circulation. So thinking back to the U.S. case, or in most traditional countries, you have cash, which gets issued by the central bank. So if Ben Bernanke decides that we need to apply another round of quantitative easing, what he's doing is actually inserting additional dollars into the money supply. In Bitcoin, this decision to introduce new Bitcoins is actually predefined in the protocol to happen at regular intervals. So every 10 minutes, a new limited number of Bitcoins is introduced into circulation. So in this sense, you have monetary policy being set by the protocol itself, not by any central banker like you'd have in traditional financial systems.
Now, these people create these bitcoins. Who owns them when they create them?
The new bitcoins that are introduced, they are owned by the miners. Now, unless you are going to want to put one of your computers that you have sort of lying in your basement to good use in mining for Bitcoin, the other way that you can actually get Bitcoins is to go online to one of these Bitcoin currency exchanges who will accept as payment dollars or euros or other hard currencies, and they will give you an equivalent number of coins based upon whatever the market exchange rate is. So right now, for example, it's around 80 U.S. dollars for one Bitcoin.
Why would we want to?
That is a fair question. Why would we want to? Particularly if we already have a perfectly functioning currency, U.S. dollar. Well, one reason why you might want to is that there are certainly some people who don't view the U.S. dollar as a perfectly functioning currency. People who worry about inflation in particular. I referred back to, our central bank, Federal Reserve, who has these adopted policies of trying to introduce lots of new dollars into circulation. This arises fears of inflation among people who already save a lot of money. And so they're worried that their holdings will get devalued. So for them, Bitcoin is a nice alternative because you have this fancy mathematics protecting the rate at which new coins are introduced into the currency. For those people who aren't so interested in monetary policy, Bitcoin still has some appeal. There are many merchants who don't like the high fees that they have to pay with traditional payment systems, so the high fees that are charged by credit card companies and credit card processors, particularly on international transactions. Bitcoin offers the promise of being able to accept those transactions, but with a much lower added cost. So that's one of the other factors driving adoption.
How safe is it? You say it's not backed by the U.S. government or any other government. It's created by some people that we don't have a clue who they are. How safe is it to, you know, to put your money into something like Bitcoins?
Well, listen to the proponents of Bitcoin, they would say it's very safe, but in my investigations and my research, I'm not so convinced. I think there are several substantial risks to using Bitcoin. The primary risk is the highly fluctuating exchange rate. So, you know, less than a year ago, the exchange rate was, you know, fairly stable, hovering around $10 to $15 per single Bitcoin. Then, beginning in the spring, the exchange rate shot up. It shot up to reaching $260 for a single Bitcoin, and it got lots of media attention. And then it all sort of collapsed back down, and now it's sort of hovering around $80. So there's certainly huge risk to anyone who buys Bitcoin in that it could be worth considerably more or less than when you initially buy it. So it's far more volatile than other currencies.
Well, I kind of think I'm going to keep my money in the can I got buried in the backyard.
Yeah, that's what I would suggest. I personally don't hold any Bitcoin because I think the risks are just a bit too great at the moment. I mean, I do think that, you know, whether or not Bitcoin succeeds, there is a bright future ahead for digital currencies in general. If Bitcoin's not the one to succeed, maybe another one that comes along can do, because there really could be a benefit to introducing more competition into our payment systems. You know, the amount of money that merchants and consumers have to pay for online transactions is pretty substantial. And so I think there's certainly room for some competition there. I just don't know that Bitcoin is the answer for that we need today.
Dr. Tyler Moore, professor of computer science and engineering at Southern Methodist University. That interview came to us courtesy of WTIP. Coming up, what a difference 6 years makes, and going cold turkey on technology. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1279. Science fiction writers have a great track record for predicting the future, from organ transplants to space travel. Many of us thought we'd have transporters by now, but it's been communication that has most drastically changed our lives in the past 50 years. The pace of that change is dizzying. Let's revisit a 2008 prediction piece from producer Jamie Corville and see what a difference just 6 years have made. The internet has woven itself into every part of our lives. What if you just pulled the plug? No cell phone, no email, no internet. Journalism professor Jennifer Rausch went offline for 6 months. Producer Sally Herships has more.
Last fall, Jennifer Rausch's boyfriend was shopping for a melon baller. You know, one of those little metal devices that scoops out perfectly round balls of melon.
And he spent hours online at Amazon reading all of the customer reviews of all of these different melon ballers. And he did get a melon baller that he was really happy with for $6. But on the other hand, he probably could have just walked to the local grocery store and bought whatever they had there and been just as happy with it.
Rausch is 41. She's a journalism professor and lives in Brooklyn. She says she wanted to free up her time from the online melon baller searches in life, to spend less time using new media, and to think about how she uses it. So she decided to spend 6 months offline.
And what does that mean exactly? Like offline completely?
It means that I have not been using the internet for email, for Facebook, for sharing photos, anything like that, for doing research. I have also not been using a cell phone.
And for the first 4 months, Rausch says she felt fantastic. She knew she'd be without digital resources, so she'd stockpiled the more traditional kind. Dictionary, thesaurus, phone books. She's even installed a landline. But she says her friends are trained to interact online.
Some of my friends have even accused me of abandoning them because I'm no longer on Facebook or in touch about their lives. And I remind them that they can call me anytime they want to and tell me about it in person.
But they didn't. So some of her relationships suffered. And even with all her printed resources, Rausch couldn't find everything she was looking for, like phone numbers and addresses.
Can you just call information, 411?
Yeah, you can call 411.
If you want to pay, and you know exactly what you're looking for. Rausch says it was hard to find things by category, like restaurants. Overall, she says shopping offline took more time, and she knew she missed out on discounts online. But it turns out she gave herself a tiny loophole. She got engaged, and she needed to start planning her wedding.
Wait a second. So you actually have been going online?
Yeah, for 1 hour a month.
She kept a timer next to her desk. But even with her 1 hour wild card, when the last month of her experiment hit, she was in trouble. The hour went really quickly.
How fast?
Well, the first day.
Rausch was searching, without any luck, for a wedding dress she'd seen in a magazine. Finally, she went online to find the phone number of the dress manufacturer.
And this was during your allotted time?
No, this was after I ran out of allotted time.
You cracked.
I did.
But that was last month. Now the 6 months are up. It's a Saturday afternoon and Rausch is ready to log on.
All right, are we going to do it?
Sure.
But she says she won't check her email till Monday. It is the weekend. Part of what she's learned offline is to set limits when on.
Don't read your email in the morning. And when you do read your email, don't read every single one of them.
Reading email in the morning lets other people set your schedule. Rausch did log onto Facebook. She hadn't been on the site in 6 months.
I have my fiancé who has posted at least 2 different cute cat videos.
And so this is what you've been missing?
Yeah, this is what I've been missing.
Do we watch a kitten video?
If you want. I love kittens.
Who doesn't? But Rausch says it would be nicer to play with a real cat. She says she's learned she doesn't need to be online. Unfortunately, her friends, family, and work need her to be. In New York, I'm Sally Herships.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.